Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Rabbi Dennis Ross, Director of Concerned Clergy for Choice for the Educational Fund of Family Planning Advocates of New York State, a multi-faith organization of religious leaders in support of reproductive rights. Ross, who is Associate Rabbi at Congregation Beth Emmeth in Albany, is the author of All Politics is Religious, Speaking Faith to the Media, Policymakers, and Community. Rabbi Dennis Ross, pleasure to have you here. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks. It's great to be here with you.
So, Dennis Ross, tell us a little bit about what has prompted all of this. Is it the perception that people of the cloth are opposed to reproductive rights?
Well, that's a very important piece of why I do this work with Family Planning Advocates and Concerned Clergy for Choice, and why I wrote this book. That when it comes to religion and our intimate lives, be it about reproductive health care, be it about same gender rights and relationships, there's a perception that one religious opinion represents all. When the reality is that when we look at what, for instance, specific faiths teach about access to birth control, different faiths have different teachings. For instance, in 1929, my professional denominational organization, the Central Conference of American Rabbis, endorsed access to birth control. That's almost 100, you know, it's over almost 100 years ago.
Is that what we call Reform Judaism?
Reform Judaism, that's right. And, you know, the Methodists were there with us. The Episcopal Church was there with us way back then in the late 20s, early 30s, believing that people, women, and families should be able to get the health care that's right for them. Many of us came to this position out of our work as pastors. One of our network members was Rabbi Balfour Brickner, one of the late Rabbi Brickner. And very early in his career, he was talking about how he was visiting in a hospital, and he sat down with a woman who was hospitalized for a pregnancy-related complication. And her question of him was, "Rabbi, is it a sin for me to get birth control?" And he had to answer no, because that's what our faith teaches, and that's what his experience as a pastor confirmed for him. And that experience led him, as he told the story, the last time I saw him, he told me this story, that experience led him to say, you know, I have to do what I can to make sure women and families get the health care that's right for them, basic health care like birth control.
But it's interesting because different religions have different ways of doing things. I mean, let's face it, the Catholic Church, the Pope is the head person, and everything flows down from that person. Whereas in Judaism, we really don't have a head person, do we?
No. Of course, again, different faiths are structured differently. But the question really is one of church-state separation, and that all of us are free to preach as we wish in our houses of worship, in our churches, synagogues, mosques, teach what we want when it comes to these sensitive, personal, intimate issues. And we're free to, in this country, thank God, we're free to make those opinions known in the public forum. We can come on the radio. We can write letters to the editor and op-eds in the paper. And we're also free to inform our policymakers what our faiths teach. When it comes time for our government to set policy, we shouldn't be picking one set of religious restrictions and saying that law is going to be the law for everybody.
Are we in danger of doing that?
I think it's happening in some cases. I think it's happening. We in New York State, we came close, but I think that religious liberty triumphed when we established marriage equality for same-gender couples. But I was in the Capitol as that bill was being debated, and we had religious people on both sides of those 10-foot-wide stone halls. It was kind of scary because there was a lot of passion in a very small space with a lot of people. And on one side of the hall, people were chanting, "God says no, God says no." And on the other side of the hall stood people chanting, "God says yes." Now, all the opposition to marriage equality in New York State was faith-driven, whereas on our side, there were religious and secular voices coming forward on behalf of this basic civil liberty. But the state very wisely decided that we will view this, or from my perspective as a rabbi speaking, we will view this as a religious disagreement. where some religions say no, some religions say yes, will establish a law that allows people to make their own decisions in their churches and houses of worship, and they can conduct whatever ceremonies they want or not in their houses of worship. They can make up their own direction for life in their private lives. And that's what we have right now, a law that respects everyone's religious liberty.
The name of your book is All Politics is Religious. What does that mean?
Well, it's just look out. You know, I mean, there's religion. Sometimes there's religion in all our public policy and political discussions. Sometimes it's pretty obvious, as it was when we were debating marriage equality or when we talk about birth control in this country. Sometimes it's you got to look below the surface. For instance, I just finished reading a book by Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma, which claims that global warming isn't happening. And as part of his argument, first of all, it flies in the face of the overwhelming consensus of scientific opinion. But what he does is he turns to the book of Genesis and points to God's promise to Noah after the great flood as proof that God will not allow the earth to be ruined again. And now he's allowed to have that feeling, and certainly people are free to preach that idea and express that opinion wherever they want. But we're looking at a situation where we're taking a religious perspective that would distort science and establishing public policy with that religious perspective contributing to that policy in a way that would strike down laws that protect the environment. So, the politics has religion in it. It just may not be quite as obvious as it is with some of the other debates.
Well, it's pretty obvious to me. I've always taught my students that politics is the authoritative allocation of scarce resources.
And
certainly, you know, there are thou shall nots, you know, in the Bible. I recently had a fun drive here at WAMC and heard from a rabbi or somebody who identified himself as a rabbi in Kingston, who was furious with me because he said that I was somebody who was talking about forbidden ways of people having sex. But there are some specific provisions in the Bible. I mean, they're always quoting, and I'm, of course, for gay marriage, as you probably know, but they're always saying Leviticus, and thou shalt not lie with man as thou doest with women, and the rest. And it's pretty hard not to understand what that means, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but when we look at those verses in context, the Bible there is talking about casual sex, sex without responsibility. It's not talking about a committed relationship between lifelong partners, the kind of household that I'm invited into to provide pastoral counsel. In my former congregation, the very first hospital call I got to make, I got asked to when I worked in Worcester, I walk into a room and there are two men, elderly men. One of them's very sick and the other one is sitting by his bedside holding his hand. Now, if these two men want to get married and one of them is at the end of his life, no religious leader, no politician should be able to say, no, you can't. This is about commitment. It's not about sex. It is about commitment through a major life crisis. So that's why I came forward. That's why the members of my Concerned Clergy for Choice network from a spectrum of denominations, Methodists, Episcopal, Baptists, rabbis, Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, why we came forward on behalf of what we see as a value and a commitment that strengthens the moral fabric of our communities, marriage equality.
So within each of these religions, that's why I brought up the business of the Pope and the Catholic Church, there are differing opinions. Clearly in Judaism, which both you and I are members of that group, there are people who sit in a more conservative view who think that you're wrong on basically everything you've been talking about today.
Yeah, I know. There's diversity across religions, and there's also diversity of belief within religions. There's diversity within my reform movement of Judaism about some of these issues that we're discussing. And there's diversity within the Catholic Church, as there is in with every faith.
Well, there is, but in the Catholic Church, there's dogma, there are rules, and you don't get to say. to put it mildly. We do know that the polls are showing that American Catholics are wildly in favor of contraception by huge numbers. Yeah. But in the end, it's like it or leave it in that religion, not in Judaism.
Well, you know, we'd have to see, as through Concerned Clergy for Choice, we cooperate in advocacy with Catholic Women Speak, which is a group of lay Catholic women based in Troy who support access to safe abortion and birth control. We also cooperate with Catholics for Choice, which is a national organization based in Washington, D.C. So within the Catholic Church, there is a very pitched debate about some of these issues and other issues, you know, ordination of women, ordination of gays. Yes, there is a hierarchy, but within the church, there is tremendous diversity. And, you know, it's a painful conversation for them. I mean, my heart goes out to the many Catholics who are torn between the way they live their lives and between what they're hearing from some of their leaders.
The name of the book is All Politics is Religious. Now, the subtitle is Speaking Faith to the Media, Policymakers, and Community. Let's start with the media.
Okay, well, here
now,
we are.
Why are you having to speak faith to the media?
Well, speaking to the media for clergy just doesn't come naturally. You'd think, well, with all the preaching we do, with all the sermons we write and teaching we do, we should be able to just sit down and have a conversation like we're having right now. But the reality is media is its own field. It's its own profession. And it's something that we have to learn about how to do. For instance, it's important to speak in a positive voice when you're talking to the press. It's important.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I could write a letter to the editor that opens up with a highly critical statement about something in an article I read. But if I open up with expressing appreciation for a point of view or appreciation for what was covered in that article, I'm taking a different perspective. And I think it's a perspective that fits my position as a leader in the community.
On the other hand, I read yesterday in the Berkshire Eagle, as we speak, a letter to the editor which says there's no question about it. The Bible just forbids homosexuality. You want to write to counter that letter. You start with something positive to say about the letter writer?
Well, it depends on the situation. In a situation like that, I would highlight that there is a diversity in religious beliefs. I think it's important when I sit down with somebody as a religious leader, I look for an area of common ground. I certainly try not to attack somebody or their position or their belief first thing. I mean, people are entitled to interpret the Bible that way. They do interpret the Bible that way. I think they're wrong. And I certainly think we shouldn't have government policies based on that biblical interpretation.
Now, just for the heck of it, Dennis Ross, what do you think of the Bible? I mean, what is the Bible? Is it a historical document? Is it something that was written for a time when you told people not to eat pork because they might get trichinosis? Or is it something that has words that we should live by forever?
Well, the remarkable thing about the Bible is that there is truth in there all these thousands of years since it was written. The most frequently repeated verse or teaching in the Bible is to love and protect the widow, the stranger, and the orphan. And when it comes to my advocacy work, we talk about loving the widow, the woman, the stranger, the immigrant, and the orphan, the youth, the teen. And that is such a powerful message that informs my perspective of how I look at our society, how I look at our houses of worship, how I approach my advocacy work and my writing, that we're advocates here for the powerless, for people who have no voice, that it's our call to come forward on their behalf. I mean, that is such a wonderful, truthful teaching. It gets debated in Congress. It gets debated here in Albany. And it's very important to me.
Dennis Ross, let's go back to the media. What do you really think of the media?
Well, it's like when if I were to ask you, what do you think of religion?
Yeah.
I mean, you got like, you know, you've got.
Hey, I didn't write this. Speaking faith to the media. So obviously, you know, this is an advocacy book.
Right.
It tells you how to do it.
How to do it.
But the premise is that the media somehow can either help you or screw you. And so this Dennis Ross, not that you're not saying the right things. You are saying the right things. But when you go to sleep at night, you say, damn them. They don't get it. They don't promulgate the truth. We have to educate them. They're a bunch of stupid jerks. I'm making all of this up. How much
you are? Because this isn't the first time I'm on WAMC or on public radio.
Yeah.
You're making it up. But the reality is that as clergy, we need to know the skills. We don't learn in seminary.
But the premise, Dennis, is what do you think of the media? Why is it that the media has to be taught about your issues?
Got it. Yeah. In part, it's because, you know, I think it's we have to become better at expressing ourselves to the media. In becoming director of Concerned Clergy for Choice, I took specialized media training. I learned how to speak more concisely, how not to drone on and on. Media professionals at Planned Parenthood and elsewhere, people who come from this field. I learned how to sit on camera, how to appear on camera in a way that makes me look better than if I didn't. For instance, how to hold my head, how not to wave my hands around. How not to bang on the table when you're getting a radio interview, so you don't. So just a lot of things that I just basically had to learn as clergy because I didn't learn them in seminary.
But I'll try one more time, and then I'm giving up and going to another subject. But do you think then that the media is educable? Do you think that in fact that many of the people in the media don't know a lot?
I think that. First of all, I know some people say the media is biased against us. They don't pay attention to us. They only want to present one side. And part of that has to do with us. And that's why I wrote the book, how to express an argument that gets the attention of the media, how to disassociate oneself from those angry religious voices and perspectives and presents an alternate religious perspective. I mean, I can't blame the media. First of all, I've been in the media. I'm here now. I've been in the New York Times. I've been in other regional and national media. So with these arguments on behalf of women and families and teens and immigrants and the like. So if you were to just, like, sit down and like do a study, how many religious voices do you hear from one side and how many religious voices do you hear from the other? Those coming with perspectives like mine are greatly, greatly outnumbered. I mean, that's pretty clear.
I don't think so.
No?
No. In fact, I think it's true that the media is divided up into different parts so that, for example, the New York Post, you're not getting an even break. But the New York Times, which is a far more influential, if not better read newspaper, you're going to find a very sympathetic ear to what you do.
Yeah, but I found even there, and I mean, I love that paper. I've been reading it since I was in high school. But time and time again in the past, when there's a religious question about abortion or birth control, or when they're discussing abortion or birth control, and they're looking for a perspective, a different perspective than, say, the President Obama might be expressing, they'll go to a religious person, and that's the counter voice. So what happens is there is only one religious voice in the paper about stem cell research, about abortion care, having safe abortion in this country. And that's the issue for us, is how to say, hey, wait a minute, there are other religious perspectives here. We've had to say that to newspapers and the media around the country.
That's a very good answer.
Oh, okay. It took a while to get there, though.
I have to tell you. Now, you're not only talking to media, according to your book, but you're talking to policymakers. That gets interesting. In the end, with most elected officials, as opposed to bureaucrats, the name of the game is to get elected and then to get reelected. So what do you have to keep in mind when you're talking to them?
Well, you know, first of all, a lot of people think that religious people shouldn't lobby. and that religious voices should stay in the house of worship and in the community, when the reality is we live in this country, religious people, just like anybody else. And every person, regardless of faith, has a right, really an obligation, to express their opinion to their elected officials. So I think, first of all—
Right there in the First Amendment.
Yeah, right, exactly. And at the same time, we have to keep in mind that when I meet with a policymaker, I'm not speaking for any synagogue or any denomination or any house of worship in an official capacity. I mean, they know I'm at Beth Emeth. They know it's a wonderful congregation if they know Albany. But I'm here to talk about what my faith has to teach. So I'm pretty clear about that. And there are a number of other religious advocacy groups here in New York State that we work with at Concerned Clergy for Choice. We work with Interfaith Impact. We work with Reformed Jewish Voice of New York State. And these are other groups who gather religious leaders to come here to meet with policymakers who want to hear what our faiths have to say.
Dennis, why do they want to hear that?
Well, they hear a great deal from different religious groups that— have an entirely different position. They'll hear from religious leaders condemning access to reproductive care, basic care that includes abortion care or contraception. They hear a tremendous amount from them. They're in the Capitol constantly, and they find us a refreshing, welcome, different religious perspective, and it reassures them that they have the moral voices and the moral stature of religious leaders behind them when they come forward on behalf of women's health.
So they're thinking, cha-ching, cha-ching, these are voters, because this is what I think these guys do. Are they going to help me or are they going to hurt me? And we see this all the time. We saw it in the Freedom to Marry Act and the rest. So people have to take chances. The Conservative Party lines up and says, okay, if you're for gays being allowed to marry, then we're not going to endorse you this time. That threat was used. Do you guys ever use threats?
No. We speak about our religious perspectives. We talk about the need for sex education for teens. Before we had stem cell research in New York State, we talked about the importance of that. But we just don't go there.
Mm. We don't. Has any political leader or politician ever gotten mad at you in a conversation?
Sometimes, yeah. You know, or there might be disagreements.
Well, could you sort of paint the picture for us?
Yeah, well, you know, we might meet with somebody who disagrees with us. We try to have a respectful conversation. We generally can. And shake hands.
But
leave the door open.
What if the guy gets in your face?
Well, we disagree. We're allowed. It's a democracy. We're allowed to disagree. But the most important visits we make are to policymakers who support our perspectives, you know?
This is something I lecture on a lot. I've taught lobbying on the graduate level and the rest. And I have to tell you, to me, it's always so ironic that people spend their time going to people who agree with them as opposed to people who don't agree with them, and which is much harder, but trying to change their minds.
Well, you know, my experience is you're not likely to change anyone's mind.
Somebody's mind got changed in gay marriage.
Yeah, occasionally it happens. Most likely, what we're able to do, you know, I was speaking in Sharon, Mass. In Barney Frank's district, and I generally say if you're able to make one call, only one call to a policymaker, call the policymaker who looks at the world the way you do. Why? Because they're the one who's going to get the bill out of the committee down to the floor for a vote. They're the one that's going to have lunch with a wavering policymaker and have them come on. So somebody said, well, you know, our congressman's Barney Frank. He's great on these issues. What can we do? I said, well, he's great on many issues, but he needs to know what your priority is. So you need to call him, thank him for his time, thank him for his courage and for his commitment, whoever your policymaker is, really, and then ask them continue to be strong and stand strong. So I encourage anybody I talk to, make a call. Call at least once a year. Call the president's office, call the governor's office, call your, especially on the state level, in the Senate and the Assembly. 10 calls in a week on an issue can make a difference.
Well, that's fascinating. I don't know whether I agree with it. I'm sure you're partially right. It's always good to reinforce people who agree with you. But somebody had to turn these other guys around in order to have gay marriage.
Well, it could well be somebody who got a call, who supported marriage equality, who got a call from one of their supporters and said, "Who can you help convince to or talk to, and who might we be able to sway?" And that could have been how it happened.
Again, let's remind everybody that we're talking to Rabbi Dennis Ross, and he has written All Politics is Religious, Speaking Faith to the Media, Policymakers, and the Community. Now, we just talked about elected officials and having some sway over them, but what about bureaucrats? Obviously, there's a whole difference in mentality in how you talk to people who are writing regulations, who are carrying out the law, and who are there for reasons different than elected politicians. Can you tell us a little bit what's happened with you on that?
Well, you never know who's going to be running for office.
No, I don't agree with that. I think most of the people, you get to be commissioner of health, you're not going to be running for office, but you can have tremendous influence on the way in which laws are carried out, whether regulations are written properly. And the bureaucrats I know have been motivated entirely differently than the people who are trying to win re-election.
Yeah. Well, we've had conversations with the commissioner of health here. I've met with the late Commissioner Daines, commissioner of health here in New York State.
Mm-hmm.
I've called Secretary Sebelius's office, Department of Health and Human Services. We communicate with them as well, too.
I mean, but this is a book of how to, and I'm asking you, Dennis Ross, whether or not there are differences in the way in which you're instructing people to deal with politicians in the electoral sense and people who have policy concerns foremost.
Yeah, well, I think it's my responsibility as somebody who lives in this country, who cares about the direction, to let everybody around know how I feel.
Mm-hmm. So. Now, the third group here is the community. So you've got the politicians, you've got the media, now you have the community. How does your group deal with that?
Well, your community is everybody from your uncle at your July 4th barbecue to a member of the clergy speaking from the pulpit. And there are ways to express oneself effectively. If you care about an issue, it's important to stick with the issue and not go beyond there. Generally when I preach, because again I serve a congregation, I don't talk about Democrats or Republicans. I don't talk about the president's policy. I talk about the issue, just like when I was talking a few moments ago about the widow, stranger, and orphan. Generally not. Now, okay, there are times when I need to, but I think one of the first things to keep in mind is, as a religious person, it's not about which party holds office or even who holds the office. It's about the policy that our nation and our state and our communities advance. So when I speak to the community from the pulpit or on a college campus, generally speaking, I stick with the issue and avoid the politics.
But wait, don't you think there's a big difference, Rabbi Ross, between whether the Democrats get elected in the next election or whether the Republicans do? If the Republicans do, you're going to find three other guys who are from the right of the judicial apparatus and who are going to be on the Supreme Court. And then it's going to be all those things which you find reprehensible are going to be reinforced. So there is a difference between being a Democrat and a Republican.
There is, but when I preach, I just don't go there. I mean, people can figure out where I stand when it comes to that kind of politics. But, our congregations and our communities are very diverse. And I respect those in my house of worship who take a position that's different than mine. And when I'm educating the community, that's one thing.
Are the very guys who are going to go to the Supreme Court and sit there and say no to abortion, no to family planning, no to this or that. How in the world can you respect that?
Well, as a rabbi, I have to respect them. I have to respect the pulpit, and I have to respect the issue. And in my experience, the most effective way to advocate for women's health is by talking about women's health, not slamming, one party or the other.
Well, to me, the idea that there are Democrats and there are Republicans. And if the Democrats win, you'll get a different philosophy on those very issues that you find so important than the Republicans. And I don't see how you can avoid that. And, you know, it may be painful. My rabbi in New York City was Rabbi Edward Klein, a great man.
Oh, yeah.
Great man at the Stephen Wise Free Synagogue. And believe me, he didn't pull any punches. So one wonders whether or not the clergy has an obligation to be heard.
Yeah, I feel that my first obligation is to look at the Torah, see what's in there, and tell the people what I see. They can come to their own conclusions, and they do.
But when you look in the Torah, you'll find what you want, won't you?
Of course, but... Yeah.
And so will they.
Of course, others will too. That's the whole point of our faith. You know, people come to, and our democracy. That's one of the wonderful things about listening here, living here, and people will come to their own conclusions. But they want to know the opinion of someone who has studied the text, who has studied the text for decades, who reads it in the original Hebrew, and has seen it through the eyes of the rabbis. In Hebrew, and has come to an appreciation of the text. That's where I'm rooted, and that's what I feel I first and foremost have to represent.
Now, you're a Jew. Tell me about Israel. Do you think that Israel, based on the kinds of things you're fighting for here in New York, where they should be?
Well, I learned a lot about dealing with diverse religious communities and religious conflict from growing up and looking at...
You grew up where?
In Brooklyn.
Okay.
Growing up and experiencing the diversity of the Jewish community in New York City.
Indeed.
Which can be a little rough sometimes. I mean, I got all my education down there. And one of my concerns as I look at this country is the kind of religious domination that some groups are trying to exert. You see it in Israel, and you can see it happening here. You know, in Israel, it's Orthodox, extreme Orthodox Judaism. Here in the United States, sometimes we'll see that within the Jewish community as well as from Christian communities as well, kind of a religious domination and an effort to establish one religious perspective as a law for everybody.
Well, so if the extreme religious group is in charge in Israel, and we know that that seems there's a little light coming through the door on that issue, but up to now, they've been the ones who provided the swing population one side or the other to get elected. Now, how does that reflect itself in public policy on those very issues you're talking about, abortion, gay rights, that kind of thing?
Well, you know, surprisingly, for some people, abortion is available in Israel. Gays have been in the military for years, and you know, so in those areas, contraception's available. So in those areas, somehow they've managed to figure out an accommodation.
So you, in your book, All Politics is Religious, Speaking Faith to the Media, Policymakers, and the Community, come up with a concept that's very interesting to me, and that is building and using a message triangle. What does triangle mean?
Well, triangle means if you get a call for an interview. I didn't know this in seminary. I had to learn it through my advocacy work. If you're taking an interview... that's maybe 10 minutes long. Not like this one. This one's a little different. But if you're taking an interview that's 10 minutes long, if you just come up with one point, when people turn on and watch you, you're going to sound a little flat. If you try to cover 6 points, you're going to be all over the place and people won't get your focus. So the ideal for a brief interview is to come up with 3 important points. Let's say if you're talking about access to birth control. You could say, these are 3 points I want my audience to come away with. The first one is there's a diversity of religious teaching about birth control. The second one is that my faith and many others believe that the woman should be able to plan her family. Could be the second point, that my faith supports access to birth control. And the third point might be, access to birth control makes for good health outcomes. I mean, it makes for healthier... When women can control their pregnancies, time their pregnancies, it's shown that the babies are healthier, they're healthier, and as a result, the families are stronger, and the moral fabric of the community is strengthened. So there's my triangle for that talk, and that's what those are the points that I might want to try to get across.
Now, in your group, you said you have Hindus, you have Muslims. Obviously, there are some real differences of opinion among these groups as to you just mentioned, for example, the role of the woman. How do you work that out within your family?
Well, within my network.
Yes.
Despite our religious differences, there are some things we all agree on, and some of them include a woman's ability to be able to get birth control, access to safe abortion, sex education for teens. These are things that we support despite our religious differences. So I think it makes for a very strong argument where only one or two faiths are visible opposing the birth control. There are so many different ones agreeing on the need for birth control as basic health care for women and families.
Have you lost the fight? The reason I say that is obviously we see many fewer doctors willing to perform abortions. And that worries me personally a great deal. But it also means that things are not moving in the direction I personally would like to see them moving.
Yeah. I don't think we've lost the fight. I think this has been, first of all, in 1921, I was bar mitzvah at the Free Synagogue of Flushing in Queens. And I was stunned to learn that in 1921, Rabbi Maxwell Silver, who was the rabbi there many years before my bar mitzvah, invited the pioneers of the birth control movement, the family planning movement in America, to speak from his pulpit way back in 1921. Why? Because this was a contentious issue then, just as it is today. And the arguments are the same. The moral argument is the same. And so first, when we look at in historic context, it's sad in some ways that here we thought the fight for birth control access was resolved, that women could get it, and we're back where we were all those years ago. But historically speaking, this is an argument that's been going on and it's going to keep going on. It's going to wax, it's going to wane. But I think here in New York State, our state legislature is considering the Reproductive Health Act, which would fix a very troubling gap in our state's abortion law, and the Reproductive Health Act would provide a health protection for a woman that in the event a pregnancy threatens her health, she will be able to get the care she needs, because under New York State law right now, she may not be able to. So the Reproductive Health Act is a necessity, and it's supported by 7 out of 10 New Yorker voters, including people of faith.
How come it doesn't pass?
That's a good question. I know the governor is for it. I know we saw a tremendous groundswell of support for it. We have a wonderful bipartisan pro-choice caucus in the state legislature that includes members of the Senate and the Assembly, Democrats and Republicans.
Dennis Ross, you know full well it's the Senate majority that is holding everything up. Otherwise, we'd have this law, right? So in being a nice guy and being politic, in quotes, you're not calling it like it is.
Well, I know the bill has passed the Assembly in previous years. It is yet to pass the Senate. So I look forward to the Senate saying, yes, we need this law. Look, it's not a large number of women, but some have had to leave the state. And if it's somebody you or I know or care about, and there is a wanted pregnancy and a medical crisis toward the end of it, you want her to have the care and protection that she needs, and the Reproductive Health Act will secure that.
There seems to be a disconnect between public opinion on these issues and policy. What's that all about? I mean, if you ask people, are you for gay marriage? The answer is yes. If you ask people about birth control, the answer is overwhelmingly yes. If you ask people about abortion, I think it's still yes. So how come, with all of that said and done, there doesn't seem to be more reflection in terms of the way in which policymakers vote?
Well, I can tell you the most of the time I spend here at the Capitol is with supportive policymakers. They are committed. They are determined, and they are putting up a good fight. I also see that through Planned Parenthood. And again, we saw it with you know, when we're talking about the Reproductive Health Act, when the Susan B. Komen Race for the Cure mm-hmm. pulled their funding from Planned Parenthood, it was another groundswell of support from their own.
Indeed.
That said, we need to mend the relationship, and we're at Planned Parenthood, we're so glad that they did. One of the reasons why, I guess that's why I wrote this book. I was giving a speech in Huntington about stem cell research and, you know, why my faith supports it. And a fellow gets up in the audience and says, you know, Rabbi, you're speaking to the wrong audience. You're preaching to the choir. We're with you. You should give this speech upstate. So a few weeks later, literally, I swear, I'm upstate in Rochester, New York, giving a similar speech. And a guy gets up, a different guy, could have been the same one, and says, Rabbi, that's a great speech, but you're preaching to the choir. Go give this speech downstate. So if upstate says go downstate, and downstate says go upstate, where should I go?
But you know what, Dennis? It's not really upstate or downstate, and you know it full well. It's the people who, they may be right, you're preaching to the choir in both cases, but it's not a matter of upstate or downstate. It's that in both places, there's some people on the other side who stand in front of abortion facilities and threaten and put up signs and in some cases, too bad, kill. And to the point where doctors don't want to do this anymore.
I understand, but the reason why when people tell me I'm preaching to the choir, I said my response is I need to preach to this choir because this choir has to sing louder. I find tremendous complacency within the communities I speak to. And there's an expectation that someone else will come forward and fix this when the reality is that someone else is you or me. That's why we need each one of us and each person listening now, whatever their issue is, whatever their perspective is, needs to call their policymaker, www.usa.gov. You're three clicks away from everybody over here at the state capitol, from your federal elected officials. Call them all. Tell them what you think. And the important thing is if you're a religious person, in terms of my work with Concerned Clergy for Choice, if you're a religious person and you support access to birth control, tell them that you're a person of faith, that you belong to a church, that you go to synagogue every week and you support this. It will come as a welcome or certainly a different perspective, and you'll get paid attention to because you're the kind of person they don't hear from that much.
Well, I'm still concerned that we're going in the wrong direction, but talk to me about things like protests where the zealots get out in front of an abortion clinic and say, you know, you're baby killers and hold up things and try to shame. How does that get countered by your type of work?
I mean, that's what we do. I'm here to provide a different religious perspective. And I know people have
But do you get on the firing line with at the point at which they're outside an abortion clinic? Do you do anything?
Yeah, I've escorted patients into the health centers of Planned Parenthood so they can get their care and reassure them that there are different religious perspectives, that I, as a clergy member, stand with them. I'm a rabbi, first and foremost. I'm a pastor. And my concern is for the patient, that it's terrible that women are vilified for getting basic health care in this country, whether it's in person at protests, whether it's in the media. It's really a tragedy. And I also want to say a word about the nobility and professionalism of the doctors and nurses and others who go to work each day and care for them.
Indeed. I think that's a very good point. Judaism, of course, has these three areas, Orthodox and Conservative and Reform and others. So what do you do within your own religion in order to bring the other guys around, the Orthodox or the very Conservative?
Well, you're not going to change them. I think it's a matter of motivating our own to come forward, to provide the reassurance that politically within your house of worship, that you don't put your job in jeopardy by telling your congregation how you feel about controversial issues. I can't expect myself to be able to change the opinions of many policymakers or the opinions of other religious people. But what I can do is strengthen the resolve within my faith community so that people come forward with a strong voice.
How do you spend a day?
Well, first I get up and exercise.
Yeah.
And that's my day today, and came into work. And most days, you know, I work both at Family Planning Advocates, and I typically go there first. And then I'm over at Temple Beth Emeth, Congregation Beth Emeth here in Albany.
What does the associate rabbi do?
In my congregation, actually, I have a lot of fun. As you know, Rabbi Scott Shpeen is the senior rabbi. And my areas of supervision are the youth group, where I get to oversee a really exciting, a wonderful program of activities for teens. They meet every week. They have educational programs. They travel. And I actually took a group of our teens to Washington, D.C. Through our denomination for a national advocacy weekend. And they went up to both senators' offices and Congressman Tonko's offices and met with the staff and talked about issues that were important to them. We briefed them, and it was just such a fun time. So that's one of the things I do. The other thing I do at the Temple is I work with our Social Action Committee, which right now is in the midst of planting a community garden where we'll have food to support our soup kitchen project and help those who don't have a meal.
So when you deal with the young people who are in, do you ever find a parent who says, not my kid?
No. No, because, you know, I'm there.
You say they're there. You took them to Washington to advocate.
Oh.
And I'm just wondering whether or not anybody in that group ever said to you, I don't want my kid advocating for something I don't believe in.
Oh, no. What happens is they advocate on issues that our denomination has endorsed. And generally speaking, a kid can find an issue from the spectrum that resonates with them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and they know uphand what we're talking about before. The reproductive health, reproductive rights, gay rights have been on the agenda. Energy, environment, Israel, a spectrum of issues that our Reformed denomination has advocated for. So, you know, if they feel they have a problem with an issue down there, they don't go, but they usually can find something that they could speak up for.
Mm-hmm. Is it your impression that the state legislature is the kind of democratic small D institution you'd like to see?
Well, we have marriage equality, which is a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
We have support for health care for women and families and women's health centers around the state. I see that happening every day. I know our state legislature gets a very bad press sometimes.
Indeed.
When the reality is, when I sit down with some of our policymakers, I can't tell you how I wish I could tell you how deep their commitment is. I mean, you meet with these people. I'm sure you know them. They have integrity. They take a stand, and they're not going to shake, and they will come forward on principle time and time again. We saw it with marriage equality. We saw it years ago when New York State passed an emergency contraception bill that Governor Pataki vetoed, but, you know, we saw the integrity, I think, of the process as well as individuals there.
Why do you think he vetoed it?
He said something, you know, it goes back a few years,
sure.
And I don't remember exactly what he
words,
said.
Yeah.
But lots of times, emergency contraception gets confused with abortion. And emergency contraception has nothing to do with abortion. It doesn't cause abortion. It does not interfere with an established pregnancy. Read the label, contraception, emergency contraception. It prevents pregnancy.
Dennis Ross, you think if you give a child contraceptive, that they'll be more likely to use that contraceptive than to forego sex?
The experience has shown, and I don't have the numbers with me now, but they exist, that giving kids, teens, sex education delays sexual activity. It means they will likely have fewer partners, and when they do have sex, they will take proper precautions to make sure they are cared for, you know, protect themselves. All sex education emphasizes, and when it comes up with the teens I work with, abstinence is the best way to keep yourself safe and healthy. Sex education expresses that and drives that point home time and time again. At the same time, teens need to know fact from myth. They hear all kinds of stuff from their friends. You don't want them acting on it. You want your kids to know the truth have medically accurate, age-appropriate information that helps them make wise decisions.
You're an ethical man, I know that, and you pointed out some of the good things that have come out of the New York State Legislature. But from the point of view of justice and correctness, do you think it's right that a state legislature is allowed to draw lines where only the majority parties can win?
Well, what's legal is legal. I haven't studied that issue very carefully to... Yeah, I'm a busy guy.
No, it's legal. You're right, yeah, it's legal. But is it right?
I don't know enough about that issue to have an opinion.
Did you write that in your book, too, that when you're confronted with a tough one, you say, I don't know.
And I
agree.
This isn't a talking point. I don't know.
Yeah. What did you major in college?
Psychology.
Really?
And I have a social work degree. Got that at NYU.
Fabulous school of social work. Indeed.
Yeah.
If you see, in retrospect, your life, which has been exemplary in terms of doing this very good work, should more clergy be doing more advocacy?
I think so. And I think many do come forward as we give them the skills, the language, current information, scientific fact to back up what they're thinking. I think many more would. It's a matter of being comfortable. It's a matter of knowing that when you get up on the pulpit, there will be people in the congregation who will disagree with you no matter what you say, no matter what the issue is. Express yourself in a way that communicates your passion, but at the same time respects those who disagree. I think this goes back to one of the other issues, some of the other issues that we were talking about.
So has anybody ever come up to you after you've opinionated from the Bema and let you have it?
Of course. Yeah. And we're entitled to disagree.
Yeah, but disagreement takes many forms. Is there ever a form in which it's just really obnoxious?
Yeah. And that's the way it is.
Have you ever lost your temper?
Sure, but not on the pulpit.
Not afterwards. Somebody comes
No, people have that right. People have that right.
Really?
Yeah, I think so.
Even though they abuse you and call you names?
Well, you walk away, or you deal with it, or you handle it. You know, as a rabbi, I represent myself, but I also represent my tradition, my congregation, and I have to carry myself. One of the reasons why I wrote this book is how to carry yourself with strong opinions in a respectful, dignified way. One of the reasons why I wrote this book is because I'm very upset about the level of discourse, the quality, the angry discourse we hear in the media, we hear in the communities. You'll hear people attacked because of their political party or because of their beliefs in a very unfair way. So I wrote this book in an effort to make a contribution towards civil dialogue on some of these difficult issues. So, you know, I mean, we're all human. We all struggle. I mean, it would be great if every time I got up and said something, everyone in the congregation said, "Rabbi, you're brilliant. You should stop talking too soon. You know, we just keep going." But you know, people disagree, and they're entitled to. And you know, they're children of God, just like me. And I've got to respect them, as I hope they would respect me.
Speaking of the book is All Politics is Religious: Speaking Faith to the Media, Policymakers, and Community. The author is Rabbi Dennis Ross. And Dennis Ross, of course, is the Director of Concerned Clergy for Choice for the Education Fund of Family Planning Advocates of New York State, a multi-faith organization of religious leaders in support of reproductive rights. And again, the name of the book, All Politics is Religious. Dennis Ross, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.